Thursday, November 25th, and you are listening to Against the Current, brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM's News Collective. We aim to bring you an alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and Lower Mainland every Thursday at 3 p.m. We're based on UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. It is important to acknowledge whose land we are on and who has been taking care of our land for centuries. I'm Trish Mahant.
I'm Tiffany Ma.
This week, we are back to bringing you a diverse range of stories from Vancouver. Yesterday, I sat down with Roman Kira from Your Nanak's Free Kitchen to talk about their work in Lower Mainland. And Tiffany had a chat with Nuno Porto, a curator of the Sankofa exhibition that is currently on at the Museum of Anthropology. First, let's talk about Your Nanak's Free Kitchen. Your Nanak's Free Kitchen is a registered charity, an entirely volunteer-based initiative that has been serving meals in downtown Eastside since 2007. This week, I spoke to Roman Kira, a member of the organization, about the work that they do and their impact on the downtown Eastside community.
First of all, could you tell us a little bit about Your Nanak's Free Kitchen and the work you guys do around downtown Eastside and the impact it has had on the community?
So, Your Nanak's Free Kitchen, we started that organization in 2006 by like-minded individuals, and really falls under the same premise that, you know, our first guru of Sikhi, Guru Nanak, started the whole concept of langar, and also equality and seva, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The idea was, you know, we have the community in the downtown east side, don't have access to meals all the time, free meals, at that time. I mean, now, obviously, you know, there's a meal being served every other hour in downtown east side, which is a beautiful thing in itself. But we thought, you know, the South Asian community, a very giving community, there wasn't that much presence in the downtown east side as far as support. So we created this organization, and with support from just a couple of gurdwaras at that time, we were able to prepare langar in the gurdwara kitchen, and then we were able to transport it to the downtown east side. And it's the whole idea of kind of making that community connection, supporting the community, right? I mean, that was the whole concept of gurdwaras too, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of a makeshift community center. So that was the whole idea. And also we wanted to be mindful that, you know, we want to provide langar to that community, but we understand the stigma behind, you know, that community, you know, coming into a gurdwara, or even like the lack of, the funds aren't always there to need it all the time in the near. And also, when you get to the gurdwara, you got people staring at you because of your smell or your appearance, etc. Right? So we thought, you know, were they more comfortable? And it was interesting from the start, because we sort of just brought whatever langar was at the gurdwara at the time and brought it over, and we realized really quickly that maybe it might be a bit too much on the side. And then our initial approach to it was very difficult for that community to adjust to. For example, sitting on the ground, right? That whole idea that everyone's equal, that's why we're all sitting on the ground. It wasn't nothing political or anything like that. And we found quickly that that's not a very comfortable position for them to eat from. So we made some adjustments along the way to accommodate that community. And besides providing meals there, it was also an opportunity to bridge not only the South Asian community, but the outside community with the downtown east side. I had that experience personally, where I had no idea of what the downtown east side was, except for whenever I drove past Hastings going to downtown, you know, you roll up your window and lock the door type of a thing, right? So bridging that gap, creating this opportunity where volunteers can have like a safe space to interact with that community and have a better understanding and really give perspective, right?
Well,
there was a lot, you know, the flagship program is providing meals, but underneath that, it's also creating that contact, that engagement, right? And over the years, it's really grown, where we've been able to, just through contact and, you know, other service providers in the downtown east side knowing about us, you know, to provide information on hey, listen, I know you guys provide meals, but do you think you guys could provide, like, socks or blankets, etc., right?
Yeah.
So we identify other needs.
Wow.
That community needs. And then reach out to other communities with the similar support system, similar issues, right? So homelessness is not just a down. It's also, you know, it's in Richmond, it's in Burnaby, it's in New West, it's in Surrey, it's in Maple Ridge, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
Communities started reaching out and said, hey, listen, are you guys doing something this way? And we're like, you know, yeah, for sure. So what it did was it created this momentum too, right, where volunteers were coming, and we created sort of, we were sort of a conduit. I don't know if that's the right word. Sort of just a way of kind of supporting any individual or groups that wanted to do something, right?
Yeah.
Over the families that would volunteer with Downtown Eastside, we would show them how we operated, like the logistics, and they ran with it and they started doing their own thing, right?
Yeah. Which,
and it helped with a beautiful thing because it creates that movement that, you know, started with, you know, our namesake, Guru Nanak Dev Ji, right?
Yeah.
So it has been, it's been a, it's just been a beautiful thing to watch grow over the years, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds fantastic. The work you guys do, it's, wow. And the fact that you were able to create such a momentum, it's quite inspiring, not gonna lie. And so because you guys do such hands-on work and in-person work, I was just wondering if COVID affected your guys' work at all with the lockdowns and stuff. And what kind of hardships have you had to deal with due to the ongoing pandemic, if any?
Yes, so initially when COVID did hit us hard, like 2019, early, what was that, March?
Yeah.
I would say February, March. Yes, for the first time, we were doing our weekly event, Langar event, in the downtown East. We had to stop for a couple of weeks, if not a month, month and a half, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact time, but yeah, we stopped, completely stopped. Wow. Just because, you know, just like everybody else, we didn't know how to approach it, right?
Yeah.
We want to ensure the safety of not only our volunteers, but also of the Downtown Eastside community, right? Because for the most part, I also work in the Downtown Eastside, and I understand that, you know, it's, for the most part, an almost isolated community, where they just kind of stay within that those that block radius, right? The 4, 5, 6 block radius. So anyone coming in and going out, you're kind of, you know, increasing the risk to an extent, right, at that time.
Yeah.
So we completely stopped, but at that we were also kind of connecting with our advisory group, which consists of doctors in there as well, and kind of seeing what sort of approach we could take, what protocols we could utilize and do to kind of still provide that meal, right? Because COVID or COVID, individuals still need meals, individuals are still homeless. And at that time, services were being reduced by other service providers in the Downtown Eastside as well. You know, like, you know, there was less staff, the meal program there, they were serving less or not serving at all due to, you know, safety concerns. So we were fortunate to have volunteers step up and say, hey, listen, there's, you know, there's grants available specifically for service providers during COVID. And we utilized that because we weren't really, at that point, we weren't really doing grants. We really heavily relied on the support of the community for, you know, funds, right? To donate food. That sort of thing. So we applied for these grants. We, you know, gratefully got, you know, received grants. And we, what we did with those money we got was we retrofitted our GNFK truck into more of a food truck where we could serve out of it. In that case, you know, we're ensuring that there's social distancing. We don't have to, we don't require as many volunteers, right? So we reduced our numbers and also followed protocol. And so once we got the grant, once we got the truck retrofitted, we went right back to Downtown Eastside and started doing the Saturday and Sundays again, right? So it did delay us a little bit, but in the, you know, what it did was it created another more efficient approach to how we serve.
That's interesting. And kind of moving to a different direction from that question, I've read that the Guru Nanak's Free Kitchen is getting a new building in Downtown Eastside, which is a huge achievement. And congratulations, by the way, about that. And what I just wanted to ask, what is the importance of getting this building and how is this going to change the future of your organization?
Thank you. We're just so excited about it. We're really actually ahead of schedule on that. We just start, we started this year with fundraising for that building.
Right.
And we weren't expecting to be able to get a building this year, but we did. Wow. It happened just by sheer, volunteer support and donor support. Mm-hmm. We managed to get a building. Was it October 7th was right. November 7th was the official possession date.
Oh, wow.
So Good and I's Free Kitchen owns a building in the downtown east side. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to have it operational next year in the summertime, hopefully.
Oh, cool. Right.
We're still going to continue to do fundraising. The money that we did collect for the building was more on a generous loan by a donor with, how do I say this, with deep pockets, right? Who wants to remain anonymous. Mm-hmm. So that was a great, serendipitous moment, whatever you want to call it, right? That kind of aligned for us.
Mm-hmm.
So what our plans with that building is really just to provide, currently we only do 2 days a week in the downtown east side, Saturdays and Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
But with that building, we have that opportunity to kind of have that same concept as a Goodwater, right? Being available 24/7, 7 days a week, right?
Wow. Yeah.
Providing meals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the goal.
And
if we can reach that goal, that would be ideal. Mm-hmm. And we also, not only do we want to provide meals, but if we have the capacity to, have programs running out of that building, right?
Oh, yeah.
So we're engaging with the local service providers there, like organizations like Portland Housing Society, Lookout, Watari, Great First United Church, great organizations down there, and just kind of identifying what are some needs that we can help fill, right?
Yeah.
What are some shortcomings or anything that our building can be utilized for, whether it be for space for interviews or space for storage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like one thing that we've identified is that there's a lack of food storage space, right?
Mm-hmm.
People donate produce, but organizations don't have big enough fridges to store it for long term, right?
Yeah.
So that's something that we will visit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So things like that. And, if you asked us that question in 2006, 2007 about getting a building, that would have been such a far-fetched notion for us.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that we were aspiring to. We were hoping one day it would happen, and that day is now. So we at Gene of K are just, over the moon and excited of the possibilities, really.
Yeah.
So it's been awesome.
Yeah, that sounds so cool. Yeah, I read in a news article myself, too, that you guys are looking into free health clinics and large, you mentioned storage facility and housing, which is so much that you can do it with that building. And you guys are gonna make
we're not under any constraints.
Yeah.
We don't have to report to anybody, right? So a lot of agencies down there, they're limited, right? So it gives us the space to be innovative.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
To be creative with that space and with as limited restrictions, right? So it's very encouraging. That's why we're pretty excited.
Wow, that's really interesting and very exciting. And I know you guys do work outside downtown east side as well, you've helped with the recent floods and the Linton wildfires that happened this past summer. It was really impressive to see how you were able to mobilize so quickly. So could you shed some light on how you were able to respond and provide help so quickly to the affected people and regions? And were there any difficulties you faced while doing that? If that makes sense.
Oh, for sure. I mean, thank goodness for WhatsApp and Signal and, all these media platforms, really. Because it's really just, mobilizing is so much more effective and efficient now with those sort of apps, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is whenever anything comes up, anything happens, a natural disaster or a need anywhere, there's always, two or three people that are thinking the same thing. They message each other and then they message other people.
Yeah.
There's discussions already happening. And these platforms are a great way of us kind of connecting everybody together and creating groups.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then also the support of Goodwaters, right? We've got a speed dial to some of the Goodwaters, and we just call them up and say, hey, listen, what are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Do you guys want to collaborate, or how can we support the initiative?
Mm-hmm.
So Goodwaters like Duk Mivaran in Surrey, Gurunanak Sikh Goodwara, they're always always open to suggestions and ready to go. And it surprises us how quickly it mobilizes.
Yeah.
And if you ask us who organized it, it's so hard to pinpoint just one person,
mm-hmm.
right? Because everybody is thinking the same thing,
wow.
and then we're able to communicate with each other and mm-hmm. utilize our networks and our resources and just come together,
wow.
right?
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of how it just happens. And really, it's so easy. Like, I mean, I'd be sitting on my sofa for the fire, for the Lytton fire.
Right.
I was literally sitting on my sofa in the morning when I found out about it.
Wow.
I can't remember what time it was when I found out about it, and I sent like 4 messages, and the next thing you know, we've got like 3 pallets ready to go.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Wow.
So it's just, it's that effective, like, you know, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And,
right? So, yeah, that's how we kind of easily mobilize. And now, with the flood, we have a, there's a, I don't want to say, when I say we, I say the community.
Right.
We've got a, like, we've got a building in Fraser Valley in the Abbotsford area somewhere where people can come and, and pick up supplies.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
Purchase supplies that are being donated. So we've been able to centralize all that.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's...
Because the good was, we're having a bad, good problem. Mm-hmm. The good problem was they were getting too much donations. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the space to store it.
Yeah.
Right? Like that. What an amazing problem to have.
Wow. Yeah. So,
and then, you know, a business owner steps up and say, hey, you could use our space, right? And it's so much more closer, as opposed to a lot of our volunteers having to commute from Surrey, Vancouver, Burnaby, all the way, you know, to the Fraser Valley.
Yeah.
You already have something sitting there, right? So it just, everything just, you know, we're so grateful that everything just kind of just falls into pieces, you know?
Yeah. Wow.
There's always one way or another. Someone knows somebody, and then the next thing you know, it's happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so impressive how just, like, texting each other and just getting the word out can get so many people involved, and people are so eager to help that they just drop everything to, you know, come together and help for this situations these. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You gotta love that.
Yeah.
Great.
Love the community spirit. So my last question is basically, would you like to tell us a little bit about how people can get involved with the Gurnonics Free Kitchen?
Yeah, absolutely. The best way, the easiest way would probably be by our website.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So we centralize everything that way, where if you want to volunteer or if you want to donate, we have links on our website at gnfk.org.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay.
And so, yeah, and it'll take you, we have an online volunteer form. We also have a hyperlink to our fundraising page, right? So that's... And then we also have, we are also on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, this would be a good opportunity, I guess, if anyone's interested in taking on TikTok for us.
Oh, wow.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so fun. Everybody's on TikTok nowadays, myself included. So, yeah, that's a great way to reach people, not going to lie. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So,
Yeah. But that's...
And that would be the best way of kind of connecting with us.
Yeah,
right?
And I see.
Yeah, and then we go from there. Like, we always need, you know, individuals in support of the social media platforms.
Yeah.
You can also use, you know, volunteers willing to help coordinate events, volunteers, you know, do the basic, like even prepare lunger and serve lunger. So there's a lot of opportunity within the organization, because right now we've kind of stepped up our game as well, right? Because now that we have a building, we're a lot more accountable, and, you know, we're looking at, you know, options as far as, like, also...
Yeah.
Like, now that we have a building, we probably want to have paid staff.
Being
a volunteer, solely volunteer-run organization for such a long time, now that we have more responsibilities, we definitely want to put people in position for that.
Yeah. Wow.
And then doing so, so, you know, we're looking more towards grants, too. So anyone interested in helping us, you know, write grants, that would be amazing as well.
Wow.
Just, there's a lot. And then, you know, we have department programs outlined in our online form that if anyone's interested in, right? So
Wow, that's so cool. It was great talking to you today, and thanks for coming on the show this week, Roman. It was it was really interesting to hear all about the organization and the work you guys do.
The haunting debut album Black Moon by Civic TV provides a cinematic backdrop, a modern-day symphony of the dark and light that is our collective reality. Take a listen to Black Moon, now available via Flemish Eye Records and on all streaming platforms.
It's Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop is Vancouver's choicest destination for one-of-a-kind artist-made prints, posters, screen prints, riso prints, paintings, acrylic paintings, watercolor paintings, ceramic mugs, ceramic plates, ceramic bowls, ceramic pots, lapel pins, hats, toques, crochet bathing suits, jewelry, trinkets, knickknacks, hand-painted signs, curated thrift, and a bunch more stuff that won't fit in this designated block of airtime. Slice of Life Art and Gift Shop, located at 1636 Venables, just off Commercial. Open 11 to 6, 6 days a week.
Do you like to stare out of the window on long car rides, thinking about your feelings? Do you like to watch the trees sway with the wind to the gentle sounds of an acoustic guitar? Then Feeling Sounds is the radio show for you. Tune in to CITR 101.9 FM on Thursdays at 4 p.m. for some soft indie music.
Sit on the carpet, sipping on chamomile, tell me a day.
Interested in making radio? How about hosting your own show? At CITR, you can make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From news, art, sports, to gender empowerment, accessibility, music, and the BIPOC collective, there's definitely something for everyone. Explore new worlds both virtually and at our station, and be prepared to have a blast with some new pals. For more information or to join, please visit citr.ca/get involved.
Welcome back to Against the Current. You just heard Roman Kira from the Gurnanak's Free Kitchen, and now let's talk about the Sankofa exhibition. Over to you, Tiffany.
Sankofa African Routes Canadian Roots is an exhibit currently on view at the Museum of Anthropology. Centering on works by contemporary artists from Lagos, Nigeria, and Vancouver, the exhibit looks at the divergent and often fragmented paths of political and cultural mobilization that African and Black people in the diaspora have taken. This week, I sat down with Nuno Porto, a curator for Sankofa. Nuno received his PhD in social anthropology from the University of Coimbra and is currently a curator for Africa and South America collections at the Museum of Anthropology.
Yeah, tell us a bit about how this exhibit came about and, you know.
Sure. Before going to that, maybe I would like to say that Sankofa, African Routes, Canadian Roots, is co-curated by myself as the responsible for the African and South American collections at the Museum of Anthropology, and by two other co-curators. One is Naya Lewis. She's the founder of Black Arts Vancouver, a festival in Gastown for a couple of years now, and she's also an MFA candidate at UFT in Toronto, and by Titi Lopez Salami, who's an artist and the curator in Lagos, Nigeria, and who's a PhD candidate at the Department of Art History here at UBC as well. Mm-hmm. And then there's a fourth curator who curated one installation. That's Shayo Tayo Olowoake. Who created an installation on twins. So it's very much a collective or a curatorial collective. Mm-hmm. The layout of the exhibit and on Sankofa, it kind of came about very organically from the discussions we were having. We wanted to do a show about Africa, but also about Black Canadians, mainly because there hadn't been any show here at MOA related to Black Canadians. In 2018, I began working with members of different African and Black organizations here in Vancouver. on this idea of how to bring them to the Museum of Anthropology and how the Museum of Anthropology could serve their agendas and their interests. We, together with Ogunzale African Awareness Initiative, the Black Students Union, and Professor David Morton from the History Department, we got a grant project to work with the African collections, and which is called Decolonizing the African Collections and Displays at the Museum of Anthropology. And it's a grant from the PUER program, which is the program for undergraduate research experience at UBC. And so what we did was to work with cohorts of undergraduate students on the African collections and creating re-descriptions for the catalog, which means to redocument the collections, to use African-based scholarship, and to review the ways the museum cataloging in a way hides different possibilities for the objects. Again, this collaboration was kind of coming slowly. And then Titi Lopez-Alami was at UBC. And so we thought, well, it's a good idea to see what people are doing in this very, very bustling metropolis, which is Lagos, with a very active art world. And she was very kind to put us in contact and to work with us on an exhibit, which is not about, you know, Africa. It's very fragment, very much dedicated to fragments and to single voices, to very particular views of the present, not so much of the past, and definitely not an idea of Africa as, you know, as the overview of a continent where 54 or 56 countries, depends on how you count it, exist. It's of course impossible to, and maybe undesirable to, do this kind of imperial exhibit on Africa. It's not what we're doing. We're just bringing specific voices to a museum platform, and to realize in this process that much of the artwork, either from Vancouver-based Black artists or from artists based in Lagos, is capable of entertaining a conversation, in the sense that they are about memory. They are about constant, systematic, deliberate erasures of Blackness or Africanness or representation in public life. They are about recentering the history and taking in the agent's hands the narration of experiences. And that's, I think, why we at some point choose the term Sankofa, because Sankofa means, it's a proverb that means go back and get it. It's a proverb that means that one should be proud of one's origins, of one's heritage, and to use it in a creative form to think of the future. It's not so much to be proud of the past, to stay in the past. It's the opposite. It's to look to the future. But coming from where I come, and using this heritage as a means and as a tool for transforming the future. And so, on the other hand, the term Sankofa as well is being used by a number of organizations all over the world to signify exactly this transformation. Mm-hmm. So it's very much a term that is related to a positive affirmation of Africanness or of Blackness in a given domain. You can have, you know, the Sankofa Center for the History of Africa in a university, but you also have, for instance, in Brazil, the Sankofa Community Alliance for the Neighborhood of Specific Places, and so on. And so we thought, well, Sankofa is a term that has a very localized origin, but in fact, it's very global. Many people even if they don't speak English, they will understand the term Sankofa coming from where they come from, if they have an African or a Black positioning. And the subtitle for the exhibit, you know, the roots and the roots, and African roots and Canadian roots, was very much inspired by the fact that relatively common Black experience is to be asked, where are you from? As if you're in Vancouver and you're Black, you could not be from Canada. And so sometimes when people are asked, where are you from? And they say, well, I'm from East Vancouver or from the West End or whatever, they are again re-asked, no, but really, where are you from? Really? And sometimes, you know, their family has been here forever. And then that made us think that there isn't the awareness that even before Canada existed, there was a Black population in the land that afterwards became known as Canada. And in fact, that the erasure, this centering of this population from public life is relatively recent in terms of history. And it has to do with forms where racism conflates with capitalism and specific forms of exploitation. And what we wanted to do was to tell our visitors, well, there is this population, they actually do great things, and it's a bit on your side to educate yourself and to relate to this side of your country, of your city.
Yeah, I want to go back to what you said about deliberately presenting a fragmented and localized story instead of, you know, unified imperial story of like Africa. From my impression when I walked through the exhibit, it seems like, of course, like you can't focus on each and single region, but yeah, it seems like most attention has been focused on Nigeria, Ghana and Ethiopia, and sometimes Central America. I'm just wondering, are there any specific reasons of picking these places?
Yes, but maybe not in the way you are framing them, except, of course, there is a dominance, materially speaking, of items from Nigeria, but from different, also from different cultures in Nigeria. And the reason for that is, of course, that we had two Nigerian, Shayo Taiwolo Owake and Titi Lopez Salami are both Nigerian, and they're actually both Yoruba. So there's that. There's the fact that Nigeria is a huge country with a gigantic population, which as a consequence is one of the countries that has more migrants in Canada.
Mm.
And everywhere in the world, to be honest. But the point of having those countries that you mentioned is an exercise in decentering a prototypical image of Africa. So what you practically don't see in this exhibit is masks and drums. And what you have as ideas which present Africa is at the entrance immediately the notion of wealth. I think we both here in North America and where I come from in Southern Europe, we are bombarded with images of Africa as, equated as poverty. And yes, it's true that poverty exists in Africa, but it's also true that that poverty is historically created by very asymmetrical relations. And it's eventually transitory in the sense that, who knows tomorrow, but the signs are that Africans can distribute wealth as well as anyone else. And so the point was to create an image of Africa based on its wealth and based on its long history. And that's why instead of other tropes, we came to agreement in the idea of talking of old religions, which are global. So we talk about Christianity in Ethiopia for many reasons. One of them is that the Christianity in Ethiopia is related to forms of writing and to a very specific form of alphabetization, of creating literacy, very much as the Adinkra ideographic writing is a form of literacy. Then we talk about Islam, and Islam is again a form of and involves forms of literacy and so on. And we talk about the cult of the Oris, of the religion of the Orishas, which is not exclusive, which means that in many places people practice the cult to the Oris and some other form of religious expression. But just to reinforce the idea that Africa is not a new thing, it has been there for millennia. And like any place that has a long history, like in a bit like humans who have aged, you have good and bad moments. We try to speak a bit of Africa outside of Africa because, of course, of the diasporas, and because we had some elements in the museum collections which allowed us to remind our visitors that one of the reasons why there are Black communities all over the world has to do with the infamous moment of the slave trade, where enslaved Africans were transported to other parts of the world within the plantation economy, which still exists today to some extent. But we tried to see a positive outcome of that, which is the fact that African forms of expression are embedded worldwide in culture and in society. Mm-hmm. And some of them even are done by the traditional methods of tie-dye and batik, which you can see in the Adiri fabrics and more industrial contemporary clothing. Mm-hmm. And so again, you have this sort of Sankofatization of materials. They're always looking back and forth. And
speaking of the clothing, the material at the center, one thing that I find really interesting, it's like how one of the clothing literally translates to like, I am intelligent. And apparently it's a response to, you know, people thinking that women are not intelligent. Tell me more about, you know, the story behind this.
Yeah, well, it's a form. There are many forms to identify the patterns. And of course, to do a specific pattern in fabrics which are either dyed or woven such as in specific forms, it's a skill. It's a form of knowledge. And so to in a way, I'm using brackets here to catalog different patterns. Different patterns have names. And sometimes, as in that case, it's a pattern that it's made by women. And it's a response. It's known as a response to a rather offensive classification of women in that area as having small brains and therefore not being quite capable of anything. And not only they are capable of creating beautiful things, but they also are capable of creating the irony of classifying those beautiful things as a response to others. Mm-hmm. But just as a reminder, when you enter the gallery, the Auden Gallery, where Sankofa is installed, you have that big wall, but with the graffiti, but also in front there's a kente cloth, which is being worn by a dignitary, right? It's the Museum of Anthropology used to have a focus on textiles. Maybe people don't know this, but it's part of the history of the institution. And that kente is was collected before the 1950s. So it's a relatively ancient and venerable piece. And it's, you know, it's it's very well mounted in the sense that it gives you the sense of someone of high rank, like a traditional Ashanti chief is welcoming you to the space. That kind of kente is known as the gold rule, and it's supposed to be extremely rare. And of course, it's not something that a commoner would wear because it's not for commons. It's for, you know, the chiefs, the aristocracy. The and so you have that very objective translation of hierarchy in the case of the kente, as you have in the other fabrics, the translations of locality and sometimes of gender. If we go, to the left, to the Islamic section, you also have absolutely dazzling agbadas or the tunics, which are extremely complex to make because they are the result of a number of stripes that create the fabric. And then there's an embroidery, which is also made by men, which takes months, if not years, to be executed, and which is a symbol of protection, which means that when the person is wearing the tunic, is being protected at the same time. It's like wearing a talisman. And so it's very poetic, the whole thing. It's not like, you know, dropping some clothes on the body and let's go to class or something. It's really a preparation of oneself to be in relation to others. And that gives an idea as well that all these elements are used in societies and by persons who think of society as being a very relational thing, which again is one of the millennial proverbs that Maya Lewis has written in the vinyl section of the show, where she writes, "I am because you are because they were." Which is very poetic and very beautiful, and it's a statement that we live in relation to others. We don't exist as you know, single individuals.
Before we end, just want to ask about, you know, the exhibit's gonna run till March next
March 27.
Year.
Yes.
Is it a relatively short exhibit period with just 5 months, or is it regular?
Well, we are still at UBC and in Vancouver and in many parts of the world. We are still under the influence of COVID. I would, you know, easily claim that the most difficult part of this exhibit was actually doing it in COVID mode, because it's exhibit mounting is a very collective endeavor. It brings together, you know, designers, the graphic designer, technicians of different sorts, advisors of different nature. And, you know, sometimes small problems which could take like 5 minutes to be solved on a normal working environment may take 24 emails in 2 days to get to a conclusion. That was really difficult. And I think the initial idea for the exhibit was to run between October and March, but we came to realize at some point that the furnishers of things that we need to mount the exhibits were not working with the usual deadlines. And so we wanted to have some comfort and some certainty about the possibility of opening the exhibit in due time. And so I think it's a good beginning. I mean, I think it's a good run. We are doing guided tours, curated tours to the exhibit every Saturday at 3 p.m. And actually the next one is going to be guided by Shayo Taiolo Ake. So the fourth curator did the installation on the twins in Nigeria. And so it's a great opportunity to be at the museum and to have a young Nigerian twin and curator explaining her work, but explaining how it integrates with the rest of the exhibit. So I would tell our listeners to come Saturday at 3 p.m. to the Museum of Anthropology. It's going to be fun for sure. And then we have tours coming the following Saturdays until the middle of December. And we begin again in January with new tours. And one of the tours, and that's that links to something we were talking earlier on Hogan's Alley, is going to be led by Stephanie Allen, who's one of the members of the direction of Hogan's Alley Society, because the City Hall of Vancouver is negotiating the possibility of offering space in the planification of the Northeast False Creek development plan to install a Black Canadian and African Cultural Center where Hogan's Alley used to be before it was destroyed by the construction of the Dunsmuir and Georgia Viaduct. And so this is not only about the past, it's very much about ongoing conversations. Mm-hmm. And we hope that by attending the exhibit, our visitors might realize that this flow of history and these conversations are ongoing, and maybe that we should take a position in regards to these decisions.
Thank you, Nuno, for coming on the show this week. Again, Sankofa African Routes Canadian Roots is currently on view at the Museum of Anthropology until March of 27, 2022.
That's our show today, folks. Thanks to Tiffany and our lovely guests for taking the time and coming on the show this week. And thank you all for listening to Against the Current by CITR News. We are here every Thursday at 3 p.m. bringing you local news, and stay tuned for more amazing programming.